tonight on Arena. We preview The Iron O's The Flying Dutchman with conductor and star, and we celebrate PJ Harvey's To Bring You My Love. You can text us on 51551 or tweet at RTE Arena. The Flying Dutchman is an opera by Richard Wagner, whose central theme is one of redemption through love. The story revolves around a legendary ghost ship and its cursed captain, who is doomed to sail the seas forever. The captain, known as the Flying Dutchman, can only be freed from his curse by the love of a faithful woman. The opera follows his encounter with Senta, a young woman who dreams of saving him through her unwavering love and devotion. Starting this Sunday, the 23rd of March, Irish National Opera brings this opera to the Bord Gáis Energy Theatre for four performances. The opera is conducted by Fergus Shiel and features baritone Jordan Shanahan as the Dutchman and soprano Giselle Allen as Senta. And I'm delighted to be joined now by Fergus and Giselle. Fergus, if I could come to you first. The Flying Dutchman was written by Wagner early enough in his career. It's a really dramatic, gothic, supernatural opera, isn't it? But this was done like Before the Ring or Tristan and Isolde. Did it suggest his future ambition, though, to write both the music and the lyrics?
Good evening, Kay. Yeah, absolutely. It's a fantastic score. It's his fourth opera. But the earlier three are seldom, if ever, performed nowadays. So it's the first one, really, that has got a place in the repertoire. And that's interesting because it has lots of Wagner's trademarks. It has really big, sweeping orchestral parts, big dramatic themes, excellent sort of singers. You need really high-quality singers with lots of stamina to sing these parts. And it has, as you've described there, it has a sort of an epic gothic feel to it that has, big themes and big ideas, and this idea of, in the end, the two central characters, Senta and the Dutchman, they're in love, but their love is really consummated through death and through transfiguration, which is a very popular 19th century theme, and something Wagner came to also in Tristan and elsewhere, the idea that you consummate your love in another sphere or another world rather than on this mortal earth. So yeah, it has all of that going for it, certainly.
And now we're going to play the overture in a moment, so maybe you'd bring us into the beginning of the opera, because that's where the Flying Dutchman and his ghostly ship make an appearance. So what happens? What's the setup?
Well, the Dutchman, as you say, he's cursed. And part of the terms of his curse are that he's not allowed land on land except one day every 7 years. And on that one day, he has to fall in love and for his love to be reciprocated by a woman. And if he doesn't manage this, or if the woman doesn't pledge faithfulness to him, he's cast back out on the sea. So he's been wandering the sea now for hundreds of years in this supernatural way, and only ever putting into land one day every 7 years. And of course, that one day is where our opera is set. So right at the beginning of the opera, you have this wonderful seascape. And it's inspired, I think, a little bit by a trip Wagner himself took on the sea when he was fleeing from some debtors. He had very bad financial luck through his life, maybe brought on by putting on his own operas. And he frequently had to sort of up sticks and leave town very abruptly. And he was in Riga at one point, and he took to the sea, and his ship nearly sank in a violent storm, but it inspired him to write this opera. And right at the beginning of the opera is when the storm, and the overture, which you're going to play in a moment, is very stormy as well.
Yes, let's hear that now, because it is all about the sea, and we get a real sense of how he creates that turmoil.
Thank you.
Yes, the wonderful overture there to the Flying Dutchman from Wagner, performed by the Berlin Philharmonic Orchestra with Herbert von Karajan. And of course, I'm talking to INO's Fergal Scheel and Giselle Allen, who plays Senta. And meanwhile, as the Flying Dutchman arrives in his ghostly ship, Giselle, your character, Senta, is back at base, but dreaming of somebody like the Flying Dutchman.
Yes. Hi, Kay. She, you know, it's an old story that she's sort of been brought up with. Everybody's always talked about the Flying Dutchman. And so she sort of has fantasized about this and romanticized it in her head, about this incredible Dutchman, you know. And so in a very innocent and kind of naive way, you know, she sort of built him up and she kind of looks at his portrait and is always kind of dreaming about him. So when he finally arrives, she just can't quite believe it.
Yes, because she has an ordinary life and a kind of fulfilled life, even though she's full of the dreams. She's like a modern day young person obsessed with a superstar or something. But she,
yes,
in her
exactly.
own life, has a boyfriend and a father and a job.
Well, she sort of has a boyfriend. I mean, Eric, who's one of the other characters in the opera, he is very much in love with her. I think she sort of maybe at one point was his girlfriend, but she's really never taken him too seriously. and so, of course, whenever the Dutchman then arrives, well, Eric talks about this dream that he has, and it's a sort of prophetic dream where he sees Senta, you know, meeting the Dutchman, and he's absolutely petrified for her. But of course, she's just like, oh my, yeah, this is it, he's finally coming. And she's just totally, right, I'm going for the Dutchman, and that's it. So it's, but yeah, she's a normal life. She's very close to her father. Obviously, she wants to do what her father wants her to do. You know, she's obedient in that way. She talks about being obedient to him. And so that's kind of the norm, isn't it? You know, you get married and dad then would be quite happy if this happens. But of course, not realizing that the Dutchman is the Dutchman.
Yes.
So,
Fergus, tell us about the Dutchman played in your production by Jordan Shanahan. He's somebody like Dracula. His reputation goes before him and then he arrives. So what does Wagner give him in terms of arias?
Well, he has a very big scene right near the beginning of the opera. It's a big 10, 11-minute introductory aria where he lays out his own background and the fact that he's cursed, the fact that he's wandering the seas for many years, the fact that he yearns for death because death is the only way he can break his curse. And he wants, you know, he drives his ship into storms purposefully and onto rocks, but he never manages to achieve this death. He tries to attack pirates, but the pirates run away from him. He's running around the world, or sailing around the world, I should say, on this ship full of treasure and gold, but it's no good to him because he has no home and he has no girlfriend or wife and he has no family. So he's this very lonely figure. He's not actually an evil figure. If you really read carefully in Wagner's script, he's quite a sympathetic figure. He's somebody who wants to fall in love with a woman and is aware that if the woman falls in love with him, it will lead to her demise, really. And at one point, he gives Senta an out. You know, he says, don't do this. It's not going to end well for you. But she is completely hook, line and sinker, I guess. She's on board for this adventure. So she throws herself into it.
OK, well, let's listen to a section from the Dutchman's aria. This is José van Dam as the Dutchman. And again, it's the Berlin Philharmonic with Herbert von Karajan.
Zugrunde gehen.
The Dutchman's aria there from The Flying Dutchman. Giselle, you can hear there your character, Assenta, is not going to be disappointed by this man.
No, she, yeah, I mean, vocally for the Dutchman, it's incredible singing, you know, and she just, yeah, she's whether it's in her head or not, she's like Fergus said, she is hook, line, sinker. She's going to do this no matter what, you know.
Now, the music of Wagner is very filmic, we would say now. I know there wasn't film in his time, but that idea that the different characters, your character included, has a theme or a kind of mini theme. How does that work in the music?
Well, she, you know, even in the overture, there's a little bit, there's one of the lines that Senta sings in one of her arias when she's talking about the Dutchman. And she, you know, so, and it kind of just keeps recurring. So it happens in the overture, and then in her, one of her arias, her big aria, her ballad later on, it happens several times. Then later on, it also occurs just before the Dutchman enters and she meets him. So, and it's very kind of, heavenly or something, you know, it's very innocent and beautiful. And so that's kind of her theme, because she is quite innocent compared to him.
Well, let's listen to some of Senta's aria. Dunja Vasovic there singing Senita's aria from The Flying Dutchman, and I'm talking to Giselle Allen and Fergus Scheel. That use of what's called leitmotif, was he the first person, Fergus, to introduce this kind of motifs that signify the various characters?
Yes, absolutely. And he would have also used them in a really interesting way, that like not alone do the characters have a motif that's associated with them, but you can also, even if a character in a Wagner opera, if a character is thinking of somebody else, their motif can be there. And a motif could be an emotion, it could be a feeling of joy or sorrow, or it could be an object like the wind, for example, in this opera, the wind and the storms have motifs that keep recurring. So it's a way of building association. And for us as audience, sort of recognizing when the same tune comes back, it'll be slightly different each time, but it comes back in many ways. And you can have music that the same tune that sounds in one section joyful or triumphant, and then later on it can be sorrowful. So it's a very clever way of doing it, and Wagner certainly led the way with doing that.
Giselle, you previously with the INO, you played the role of Elektra in the Richard Strauss opera. Mm-hmm. Is there any comparisons between the characters? Giselle seems to be a quieter, but yet completely as passionate, probably, as Elektra.
Yeah, I mean, Senta is, you know, once she's committed to something, she's really passionate about it, and her emotions are big. And Elektra is kind of the same. I mean, Elektra would be a bit more, I suppose, right from the beginning, full on. But yeah, they're both very passionate characters, and both have a strong belief in what they're about to do. Elektra was the same. She was gonna, you know, take revenge, you know, no matter what it took. And in the end, of course, she dies also. Mm-hmm. I keep playing these characters who end up this way. And Sent is the same. But I mean, yeah, Sent is also, she knows her fate. She says it when the Dutchman, as Fergus was saying, the Dutchman says, listen, you don't have to do this. You know, I'm giving you an out. And she goes, no, I know exactly what I have to do. And I was almost like I was born to do this. This was my destiny.
Now, Fergus, I know that before the INO, you did a production of Tristan and Isolde, but productions of Wagner are not that done that often in Ireland. Is that fair to say?
It certainly is, yeah. So in terms of Dublin audiences, this will be the first Wagner opera since 2012 when we did Tristan. And before that, it would have been 2001. So it's like it's only the third Wagner opera in 25 years or so. So it's a very rare thing. And one of the things which I try to explain to people is that because a lot of opera-going audiences in Ireland may never, in fact, have been to a Wagner opera. And the effect of what Wagner does with his large orchestra, large chorus, big emotions, the scale of the emotion is so large that it's sometimes, if you listen to it, even the clips you play now, or if you listen to a CD, it sounds out of context, it doesn't sound quite the same. But when you come to see the opera in its totality, it's like this really powerful experience, which I find, for me, when I go and see a Wagner opera, it sort of stays in my memory banks for a very long time afterwards. It's quite a moving and powerful experience.
Yes, because he builds the momentum and keeps the momentum going. I think even he never wanted to have an interval in his operas, did he? He just wanted this kind of whole immersive experience.
Well, yeah, certainly. I mean, in this opera, he's written it in a number. You have an option. You could play it all the way through. There's about 2 hours, 10 minutes of music. So sometimes it's performed straight through with no interval. But we are taking an interval, which is another option. So it'll be about 2.5 hours in total, including the interval. And we just thought for audiences, for their comfort and for their giving them time to digest what's happening, it was good to do an interval. But yeah, it can be performed right through. And some of his operas, of course, are very long and massive in scale. This is one of his earlier ones. It's not so long. It's quite approachable. If you haven't been to a Wagner opera before, it's quite tuneful. There's fantastic characters, a great story. So it's well worth it. It's a good entry point to Wagner, I think, for people who might be curious about him.
It absolutely sounds like that. And the music is so dramatic and the singing so glorious. Giselle Allen and Fergus Shield, thank you so much for talking
to
us.
Thank you, Kay.
Very welcome.
Thank you, Giselle. The Flying Dutchman will run at the Bord Gáis Energy Theatre in Dublin this Sunday, March the 23rd, and then on the 25th, 27th and 29th of March. More details and booking information can be found on boardgáisenergytheatre.ie. From the outside, the Robinson family in Nancy Harris's play Our New Girl have it all. Dad Richard is a plastic surgeon doing charity work in Haiti. Mum Hazel is given up her career as a barrister to start her own business importing olive oil from Sicily. They also have a lovely home in London, an 8-year-old son Daniel and another baby on the way, and Richard has even employed a new nanny, Annie, to help out. But the play opens with a scene straight out of a horror film. Daniel is in the kitchen alone at night, in silence, getting himself Dettol and a first aid kit and a sharp knife he brings towards his ear. Rhian Jeffrey directs a new production of Our New Girl at the Lyric Theatre in Belfast. Mark Cooperman plays Richard, and I'm delighted that both join me now on the line. Rhian, Daniel playing with knives is by no means the last of these couples' problems. Just bring us into the lives of the Robinsons, if you would.
Yeah, of course. So it's a psychological drama thriller written by Nancy Harris, who is a phenomenal writer. So I would love the audiences to feel that the Robinsons could be a family next door. They, you know, could be from down the street or further afield or the city across. Like the danger in the play for me comes from the normalcy and the domesticity of the play. So yes, they are a family with privilege. They live in a beautiful house in London, but their lives are far from perfect.
Now, Mark, you're very welcome on Arena. Richard isn't in the first scene of the play. That scene is between Hazel, who is your wife in the play, and Annie, who is the person you have bought, the nanny, brought in to help Hazel and your son Daniel. But the thing is, your character Richard has hired the nanny without telling his wife Hazel. So bring us into the dynamic that happens then when Hazel is confronted by the new nanny.
Yeah, well, I suppose that is at the beginning of the show, and it's kind of, I've gone behind my wife's back per se. She has said that she's finding things difficult raising our son, and just life itself is tricky. So without any consultation or without talking to her, I have hired a nanny to come live in our house and help raise our child. And so it's kind of a bit of a, I've gone behind her back per se, and it leaves her in a tricky situation as to how to take the nanny on board or not, or to how to work this, deciding that I have made this decision around her.
Yes, because your character is a kind of a hero stroke husband, but they are quite separate, the two notions. You may not be a hero husband, though.
Yeah, that's very true. Yeah, I think that's both husband and wife in the story are kind of very high achieving people, you know, within their fields, law and medicine, have done incredibly well all the way through their careers. And just that idea that sometimes there may be aspects of your life that you're not brilliant at and that you can't see that, whether that is being a husband or a father or, you know, the elements of being within the home. Doesn't get the same level of attention or care or insight as the work outside the home.
Yes, because his job is as a surgeon, and he does plastic surgery in London. But he is a deeper person than that, he would say.
Yeah, I think so. I think he kind of almost seems kind of turn like mocks his own work, the plastic surgery element, or seems to have a strange relationship to that, or the people that go and seek his help through the plastic surgery. But he's redeemed, or he feels he's redeemed as a human by the work he does as a volunteer with, I suppose, a Médecins Sans Frontières situation, where he goes to war-torn areas or places around the world with very little medical access. And he then goes in for months at a time, I imagine, away from family, away from his son, away from his wife, donating his skills to help people and then to return home.
Now, Rhian, it is a psychological thriller, as you say, and quite a thriller at times. And the scariest thing in the house, you would think, for many of the scenes, is the 8-year-old boy. Tell us a little about Daniel and his issues.
So Daniel is an only child. He has no real interests that we see in the play. He spends an awful lot of time with his mother, Hazel, who herself admits that she has a difficult relationship with her son. Kids are smart. Like, he listens to everything. He hears everything. And he's quiet. And I think the lack of communication and the lack of maternal instinct, if you will, and the bond sort of creates a much more of a distance with Hazel and Daniel in the play. And I think Hazel's also 7 months pregnant at the start of the play. So all of the issues that she might have had with Daniel as a young child have probably resurfaced. And it's quite a fractious relationship. But I think also it ends in a hopeful note. And I'd like to think that, you know, Hazel and Daniel go on to have a happier relationship as mother and son. But there's one of the things that Nancy does is that she gives us so many choices to make. So we can sort of push Daniel into the, is it more like a la Damien from The Omen, or is he just, you know, a really neglected child who's looking for a bit of attention? So, I think the audience will have to wait and find out. And we have two boys sharing the role as well, and both boys are completely different from each other, which makes it exciting for the audiences, I guess.
And maybe exciting for the other cast members as
exactly,
well.
Exactly, yeah.
Mark, you've got a different boy, son to deal with every night.
Yeah, it's magic, actually. It's amazing. The two, they're brilliant, really, really brilliant. And just their freshness and their originality and their take on scenes and the story and their ability just to pick up and run with it and not second guess things, and just the level of truth and honesty. It's amazing to be around, and it really lends a sense of play and truth to all of our work, I think, anyway.
So, Rhianne, another question that is posed going back to Hazel and Daniel's relationship is like, what if you don't have that maternal instinct? You know, how do you cope in a culture where it's so lauded and respected? And I suppose Annie, who has such an easy relationship with Danny, that is the nanny, it kind of shows up Hazel's lack of easiness with her son.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I think it's funny because this play was written in 2012, but actually, like, the motherly instinct and therefore lack of, like, is still such a taboo topic in society today. And it's only recently being sort of explored now in mediums, be it TV, film, whatever it is. Like, we watched we've been constantly talking about modern references because we are set in our version of our new girl in the present. But yeah, I guess it's every mother's worst nightmare. And it's interesting because there's people in the rehearsal room that have children, there's people in the rehearsal room that don't have children, people that might want to. So we kind of get like all experiences from the spectrum. But the one thing that we all have in common is that we've all been a son or a daughter. So having that bond with a mother or a mother figure is something that we can all relate to. But I mean, myself and my partner are thinking about having kids at the minute. And in the rehearsal room, I'm like, is this something we really want to do?
Yeah.
Like, what if I don't have the maternal instinct? But I think it's a really important question to ask. And there's an amazing monologue from Hazel at the end. And it's like, sometimes we have to take care of things we're frightened of. And I think a lot of people will be able to relate to Hazel in some way. Like, I think she's got a lot of redeeming qualities, but the one thing that she is truthful and honest. And I really appreciate that from a character.
Hazel, we should say, is played by Lisa Dwyer Hogg.
Yes.
Annie is the nanny that Mark, your character, Richard, employed. She's played by Jean-Nicole Nionley. And tell us about Annie. Is she not simple, but simple as in her needs and her understanding and her experience of life, country girl from Sligo? That is what she seems to present herself as.
Yeah, exactly. I think she's definitely like this external energy that comes into the house and is written as being a very, very different, having lived a different place, lived a different life, a very different experience. And even her experience of childhood and her experience from her parents being so different. So bringing that energy in and how that works. And I mean, yeah, I suppose that Richard has to back up the idea that it was his idea to bring Annie in and has to facilitate that and encourage that as being a really healthy, good thing in the house. And that it's something that he doesn't want to admit that maybe this may have been a mistake at any point, and that he's dogged in the fact that this is something that Hazel needed or didn't realize she needed, and then his decision to do it is final per se.
Yes, it's funny, isn't it? Strange when you make one decision, which may be a bad decision to impose this nanny on a family, then it impacts that whole relationship, which kind of just gathers more and more heat, really, because your character is seen to defend Annie, which makes Hazel wonder what's going on here.
Yeah, it's that thing that can happen in any dynamic where an external energy comes in. I mean, it's even that thing I was thinking of my parents, you know, when they start talking to each other through the dog, just that third party coming in. And it's like, will you tell her to, you know, that kind of thing. So when Annie comes in, there are conversations happening across two and three tracks in the room at the same time. And things are being said that are hard to say directly to your wife or to your husband. They go through the nanny. And so, yeah, that level of truth goes up, or conversations that they've never had seem to happen through the nanny. And I think that definitely shifts the dynamic in the house.
Rhiann, Nancy Harris has brought a whole new kind of energy to the theatre in terms of these domestic, often quite upper middle class scenarios she presents.
Yeah, she absolutely has. And I think what she does, like, I always say that one of the reasons why we make theatre is to express more fully what it is to be human. And I think Nancy does that and more. You know, she manages to tackle, like, themes about marriage and maternal instincts and privilege and class and gender roles and domesticity and all of, like, toxic relationship, gaslighting. The list goes on and on, but in such an accessible way. And although the play has so much to say, it's also so witty and so clever and so entertaining. Like, we're constantly laughing in the rehearsal room. And her, I think one of the things that I really want the audiences to leave with is that, you know, a quarter of them are in Daniel's side, a quarter of them on Hazel's, a quarter of them on Richard's, and a quarter on Annie's, like, because you constantly shift your sympathies from character to character, which I think is so powerful in her writing. And there's not one line that I would want to cut out of the play as a director. I think she's fantastic.
Yeah, Richard, as we know, Hazel is now given up her high powered job as a lawyer, and she's now importing olive oil. And this whole scenario that we have garnered from her, and that Richard explains later about what happened in Sicily on their holidays, is fascinating.
It is. I mean, I think it's that thing. I don't know how many people can relate to that. It's the kind of illusion of walking into an environment where just everything seems to be easy, or you know, you walk into a restaurant or a bar, and that notion that, like, oh, I should open a restaurant, I should open a bar. This looks, you know, when somebody's very good at something and watching them from the outside, it seems to be very easy. And there's just that romance of, you're on holiday, they go away to Sicily, they go to this restaurant, and there's a woman there who's managing to run the restaurant, feed her children are around her. There's beautiful image of the working mother raising children and running a whole restaurant at the same time, entertaining this family who've come over on holidays. And the idea of you know, the dream of that, of like, could I do that? Why can't I do that? That's what I'm going to do, and bringing that idea home. And often these kind of borrowed holiday ideas don't really translate very well when you bring them back to your own home.
Exactly. And especially, Rhiann, as we're observing this very uptight woman, Hazel, it looks like the most unlikely kind of role she should have, as this kind of Italian mama with, you know, running an olive oil farm.
Yeah, it's definitely opposites attract, don't they? Like, it's probably as far from her life in that moment as possible. And it's like total escapism. Like, I think we all do it, you know, but I think she kind of realizes towards the end that she might never be that, and that's okay.
Well, look, it's something very much to look forward to. I enjoyed reading it so much today. Our New Girl by Nancy Harris is at the Lyric Theatre in Belfast from the 8th of April to the 4th of May. Further details from lyrictheatre.co.uk. And my thanks to Rhiann Jeffrey and to Mark Huberman for talking to us about that. PJ Harvey's groundbreaking 1995 album, To Bring You My Love, saw Harvey step into a fully realised solo identity after disbanding the PJ Harvey trio. Produced alongside John Parrish and Flood, To Bring You My Love showcased the evolution in sound, incorporating blues, gothic and industrial influences. At the time when Britpop dominated the UK charts, Harvey carved out a space entirely her own, delivering songs that explored themes of love, obsession and power. The album propelled Harvey into the mainstream consciousness while maintaining her uncompromising artistic vision. I'm delighted to be joined by Kate Brennan Harding from our Galway studio to tell us more about that seminal album. Kate, PJ Harvey had already made a name for herself with two other albums, Dry and Rid of Me, but this was a huge, I don't know, if evolution at least, if not development.
Well, it was definitely, yeah, I suppose when you can look back with the benefit of 30 years, you can look back and go, oh, I can see where she was going with this. And then you can obviously see, you know, she's had a total of 10 albums. She's been nominated for numerous Grammys. She's won the Mercury Music Prize twice. You know, so we're looking back at a woman who has continuously evolved and developed her sound. But I think what's really interesting about To Bring You My Love is that the first two albums, while they were to some acclaim, her first gig, actually, she had a woman standing shouting at her, please stop, I'll pay you to stop singing. So she went from, you know, growing up in a rural kind of ideal, I suppose, to then developing into her sound, creating music that was already abrasive for people. So with that abrasive sound and that need for perfectionism, she, for the first two albums, up to 1992, the British music scene in particular had sort of taken on, oh, who's this amazing new person who's sort of pushing the boundaries? And we have to remember as well, like women in rock and women doing something, especially speaking about sexuality and specific themes in terms of, you know, lust and obsession, and then mixing those in, say, with, you know, religious iconography and anger and rage and utilising her voice in different ways. That wasn't really too heard of in that decade so far. She influenced Shirley Manson of Garbage. There's often comparisons made to Patti Smith, although I've seen PJ Harvey has said numerous times that's lazy journalism when somebody does that. But you can't help but hear a certain similarity, even though she has always said she hadn't listened to Patti Smith before. So she developed that herself. But I think it's really interesting when we get up to Bring You My Love, she has already gone through moving to London. She was accepted into St. Martin's College, and the whirl of the city and the whirl of the London city life didn't agree with her, and she ended up going back home. St. Martin's didn't keep the college course open for her because she found London too aggressive, non-friendly, and she actually felt more isolated there. So she got all of that sort of anger and passion out in the previous albums, and this one she developed into characterization. So she developed a persona on stage. Even the album artwork on this, she's lying in a pool of water. You can see her very distinctive red lips. She's wearing red dress, and it's kind of evocative. You're not sure where we're going to go with this album before you start listening to it, because remember as well, in the 90s we had to buy everything physically, and it was CDs were the big one then, CDs and tape, and I actually had this on tape, and you were looking at the album artwork before you got home, before you could play it.
Let's dig into some of the tracks on the album, Kate. Come On Billy, there's raw emotion in this track, isn't there? What kind of persona is she channeling here?
Well, the thing with this one is, so the track before that called Working for the Man is really dark and it's really grim and it's really kind of using all these tones, and her voice is barely laudable. When Come On Billy comes on, there isn't even a second gap between the two songs. This snaps us out of that darkness, and it's like she's there just swerving into a different direction. There's gorgeous acoustic guitars accompanied by strings, and Harvey's vocals are aggressive here. So in the previous track, she was being the demure kind of chanteuse. In this one, she's singing about, you know, please come back and meet your son that you've never seen. And actually, another little bit of pop culture around that track is VH1, the rival of MTV at the time, refused to air the video because it was so dark, because she was showcasing a character of obsessional love, and sort of it flitted between her being set back in a kind of cowboy deep west time, dressed up in sort of some old timer pub, trying to, you know, get her man, Billy, to come and meet his son. And then it fast forwards to probably what would be considered of a time. And it's controversial because she tied his hands up, which is very tame for these for nowadays. But that's why it's very interesting.
All right, let's listen to Come On, Billy. That's Come On, Billy, from To Bring You My Love from PJ Harvey, which is celebrating 30 years this year. So just, Kate, we're talking to Kate Brennan Harding. Kate, can you just bring us into the cultural landscape of 1995?
Well, I can. I can bring you straight back there with, Kay, were you ever privy to doing the Macarena on a night out?
I just refuse to answer that.
I know, I'm sorry, I had to put you on the spot there. But the Macarena was one of the biggest selling songs in pop culture. Coolio's Gangster's Paradise, that was massive in the States. We had you, Britpop obviously, but it was the biggest year of Britpop in terms of the rivalry created or manufactured or not between Oasis and Blur. Blur were releasing Park Life and Oasis were about to release What's the Story, Morning Glory in August. So it was also, if I remember correctly, a very hot summer, and there was so much kind of, if you look back at the albums that were number one or in the charts at that time, you had Annie Lennox, you had Celine Dion. It was a multitude, a hotbed of lots of different types of music. And there was so much room for something that PJ Harvey was doing in terms of, you know, coming in and owning a space that traditionally was being owned by the male voice or the male landscape, like Nine Inch Nails, U2, you know. She actually was hugely and grew up hugely in awe of Captain Beefheart. And actually in the song To Bring You My Love, the opening lyric is the same as the opening lyric for Captain Beefheart's debut album, which I thought was a curious little bit of information, because she grew up with her parents playing all of this music for her and encouraging her to be completely absorbed in creating whatever it is, whatever world she wanted to create. And that's why we end up now with PJ Harvey, who can, you know, she's a multi-award winning actor, she's a multi-award winning ceramicist an artist. But going back to 1995, and aside from the Macarena and all of us trying to do it or not trying to do it, what we had as well was a culture where the press and radio was so vital for bands and acts to be put in front of, say, teenagers or people in their 20s who wanted to devour new music. And it was vitally important that the British press, in particular like NME, got behind PJ Harvey. And our own Hot Press here did an amazing interview with her, which I think was put up to celebrate the 30 years.
Yes, I was reading it, yes. Yeah, very good. Excellent interview, yeah.
Really brilliant interview, because you don't often get PJ Harvey talking now, and it's very difficult to get her to talk about personal circumstances or personal things. And she also says in that, which is 30 years old, that she doesn't like people to try and figure out what the songs are about. She wants people to make their own meaning, to make their own mind up, because once she's released it, she has to let it go. She can no longer be a part of it. It's what you make of it yourself. So with this album, though, she is, when we're talking about, like you heard Come On Billy there, mm-hmm. that is more an accessible song in the album. There's a lot of songs in the album that when you first listen, you're like, whoa, I need to be ready or prepared for this. And then you start listening to her lyrics in a deeper realm, and they're very dark, they're very obscure, they're very gothic. She really, really goes there in terms of feasting on female experience.
Well, we'll play the title track now. Do you want to bring us into that one, Kate?
Yeah, so this is the first, it's a title track, and because she had complete control. Yes, she was working with two brilliant producers, but she wasn't in the trio anymore and the book stopped with her. So this one she brings in, and I was born in the desert, I've been down for years. You'll hear it. It's magnificent.
I was born in the
the title track to Bring You My Love from PJ Harvey's 1995 album. I think it was in that Hot Press interview I was reading that she was talking about using dreams to free her imagination, and not that the dream, not that she transposes the dream into the song, but that it opens her imagination, and you see it there, these evocative pictures that she creates.
Absolutely. I think as well, like, she's always spoken in numerous other spaces. You know, she's got and one of my favourite of her albums is the Hope 6 Demolition Project, which I think came out in 2016. And she's always kind of either looking at kind of different spaces and how she could create something. And her dreams in the past, she said she would write them out to continuously keep that childlike sense of play open, where, you know, anything and everything you can conjure up yourself. And she definitely still uses that. But like in terms of, say, I mentioned the Hope 6 Demolition Project, or, you know, Stories from the Sea, Surface Stories from the Sea. She brings in a characterization that she's probably imagining part of her own identity that she may not be expressing, or at least that's how I see it. Again, we go back to her stage presence and her costumes and how she has manifested herself into this very theatrical performer. And I think doing that probably allowed her the space to put a gap between her audience and the underneath the Polly Jean Harvey. So PJ Harvey is her persona, and then at each, like in To Bring You My Love, there are several different characters. It's almost like she's trying on a different character for each story and maybe calling somebody, telling them her woes or telling them her obsessions. So each single thing does feel dreamlike, even though she did say and has said that she wouldn't directly take the dream into the song. Does that make sense?
Even though she's able to separate the Polly from the PJ, she has been pursued a lot by the press in a negative way, hasn't she? And lives a very secluded or careful life in terms of press.
I think getting that goes at back. Her. Yeah, I think that goes back to the days when in like 1992, 93, she moved back to live with her parents, and then she actually took a year out and bought a cottage for herself. And, you know, just she has spoken in the past how money and all of that sort of stuff doesn't really mean anything to her, that what means something to her is just quality of life. And I think all of the press kind of course, they're going to be fascinated with her, but at the same time, they tend to pull women who speak out apart. Like, we look at Sinead O'Connor for an example. Actually, we look now, I mentioned Shirley Manson from Garbage earlier. You know, anybody that puts themselves out there in a way that is not necessarily deemed feminine or keeping yourself in this particular lane. And PJ Harvey is one of those people who has also done that and has also kind of probably, and I would imagine definitely, inspired so many female artists or artists that are in the non-binary realm who don't fit into, you know, maybe a masculine world. And she's done that by creating songs that you wouldn't expect and songs that take you on a different journey.
Now, last night we played Down by the Water in anticipation of you coming on to talk about the album. It is a pretty distinctive song on the album.
Well, it would be the biggest song on the album, and it's like, it's got, I know that we shouldn't really look at Spotify streams, but it's at 54 million streams, which tells you something. The rest of the album has about the 9 or 3 million mark. This song is, I would imagine, the most one of the most recognised, and was the one that absolutely propelled her into, I suppose, across the water, transatlantic, huge, huge fame for her independent alternative music.
Well, I will say thanks to Kate Brennan Harding, and thank you for celebrating the 30th anniversary of PJ Harvey with us, the PJ Harvey's album, to Bring You My Love. I'll say the credits first. That's it for tonight's show. Liam Murphy and Paula Shields were the researchers. Tommy O'Sullivan was on sound. Ollie Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator, and tonight's show was produced by Reg Luby. And let's listen to Down by the Water.
I lost my heart under the bridge.